You guys can open up to Genesis, where we're going to be looking to begin today. You'll remember last week we began looking at what it means for Jesus to be the Christ. And what is it, the whole idea of the Christ, the Messiah? What is this entire concept? And we talked about how much the New Testament looks at this issue as a question needing to be answered, central to the person and work of Jesus Christ and who He is, central to the whole message of the Gospel. Is Jesus the Christ? And what does it mean to say that Jesus is the Christ, the Messiah? And at the end of our lesson last week, we began to look at just briefly, or rarely, we just had a list of them on the list of passages on the notes that we really didn't have time to look at much at all. But there are a number of Old Testament passages that are very key to developing the concept of the Messiah, the Christ, the one that's expected to come. And we're going to spend the next few weeks sort of tracing out some of these key passages. And today we're going to begin in Genesis chapter 3, where we'll find the very first of these promises, the first of these prophecies. We'll look at verse 14 and 15. You guys remember the context fairly well. Creation takes place in chapters 1 and 2. The earth is created and everything is wonderful. And then chapter 3, the fall of man, where Adam and Eve disobey and take from the fruit of the tree that was not allowed for them. And in chapter 3, verses 14 and on, God comes, confronts them, and curses those involved, first the serpent, then the woman, then the man. Verses 14 and 15, this is the curse on the serpent, and this contains a key verse pertaining to our subject. So the Lord God said to the serpent, "Because you have done this, you are cursed more than all cattle, and more than every beast of the field. On your belly you shall go, and you shall eat dust all the days of your life. And I will put enmity between you and the woman, and between your seed and her seed. He shall bruise your head, and you shall bruise his heel." Verse 15 in particular, that second half of the verse, where it says, "He shall bruise your head, and you shall bruise his heel." This contains and is referred to on the notes there. You can see it, the proto-evangelion. What that simply means is the first gospel. It's a common way of referring to this promise, this prophecy about one who will come. He shall bruise your head, you shall bruise his heel. A number of things we'll talk about there, but most people understand this to be containing the first promise of the gospel. The proto-evangelion, first gospel. At the same time, there are a group of people, commentators, who don't see this as a gospel promise. So let's briefly look at how to interpret this. How we come to a promise like this, do we see this as a promise of the gospel, or is it something else? We need to try to understand it. Some people consider it basically simply this, a description of the natural relationship between man and snake, serpent, perhaps even more than that, the entire created order of animals, but particularly the serpent. And this is all God is dealing with here. They'll note some things such as this. Nowhere in Genesis 3 is there going to be a reference directly to Satan, to the devil, to the evil one, to anything like that. It's simply the serpent. Again and again, that's the only reference directly and explicitly that is made. There is no reference beyond that in Genesis 3 of any direct nature. They also note things like this in this promise. Notice those last two lines of verse 15. "He shall bruise your head and you shall bruise his heel." In the King James, I believe it is, that there's a different translation there between bruise. This is the New King James we're looking at here, where "he shall bruise your head and you shall bruise his heel." Some translations differ in the verb there. One is bruise, the other crush, perhaps strike and crush. And there's an implication there that one action is much stronger than the other action, when in fact the verb is actually the same in the original language. And so some people will look at that and say, well, you see it here, this is just talking about this back and forth sort of even-handed contest. Both are doing damage. Both are bruising. It's not that one is doing a little bit of damage and the other is completely destroying and crushing. It's the same verb here. They'll make an argument based on that. And even beyond that, you might say, the serpent sort of gets the last word in this prophecy. the seed of the woman will bruise your head, and yet it saves the final word for the serpent in a sense. You shall bruise his heel. And so they look at that, and then the context of verse 14 in particular, in this curse, because you have done this, you are cursed more than all cattle, more than every beast of the field. On your belly you shall go, and you shall eat dust all the days of your life. It's just simply talking about how the serpent is going to be, they say. That's just a very natural description. That prior to the fall, the serpent did not have this disgraceful place in the creation, but now he does. Now there's a curse upon him. Out of all the animals, he will have the greatest hardship in a sense. So all that adds up, and there's a group of people that look at this and say there is no gospel promise, no reference to Messiah, to Christ, or anything of that sort, no promise of the redemption of mankind, but simply saying now that there's this initial encounter between man and serpent, this is going to continue. The serpent will be cursed, and man and animal, man and serpent in particular, they're going to be at enmity with each other. And we know that certainly people don't like snakes too well. We see a snake and that's a problem. Well, on the other side of it, again, we're trying to understand how to interpret a passage like this. What reference does it have, if any? The other side of it would be that this is the first gospel promise. That this is a promise of the redemption of mankind. In response to some of their arguments, one of the first things that you might say is that enough for a verse like this? Is there more to the situation than just what they've explained it as? Sometimes, you'll find this to be true, that people of some opinions almost empty the Bible of much meaning. They look at it and they interpret it, they find a simple natural explanation for everything, and before you know it, there's no reference anywhere in the Old Testament to Christ. There's no reference anywhere in the Old Testament to the Messiah. Almost everything is gone, and you boil it down to just very naturalistic explanations. Almost no sense of a supernatural element in Scripture anywhere. And yet we know that the Bible is a supernatural book. It's full of divine truths and divine concepts, far beyond just natural things. So the context here implies a little bit more. Now, we do have to be careful. I want to spend just a moment making sure we realize it's very easy also to read into the Bible more than is there. And this is what is true about what they might say on the other side of things, that, well, you have to be careful not to read too far into it. And so you have to be careful both sides. On the one hand, you can read too much into things in the Bible that really aren't there. And on the other side, you can empty the Bible of all its meaning by explaining things away and not giving full justice to what is there. The question is there anything in this passage that validates seeing this interpretation? And are we giving full weight to the context of what's there? You can do what they call spiritualize or allegorize the Old Testament very easily if you're not careful. And what that simply means is you take a story in the Bible, you take some type of text in the Old Testament, usually in particular, and you turn it into a grand story that means far more than it does. An allegory is where you have a simple meaning of literal meaning, this happened and so forth, this person did that. And that's one level of meaning. But you say, but each of these people and events must symbolize something deeper and more and hidden that you don't see at first. It's always a good laugh sometimes that our pastor has when he tells, I've heard him tell it numerous times, of a sermon he heard in regards to the person of Samson. Some of you guys have probably heard this story. But he said he was hearing a sermon one time, and the person took the story of Samson. When Samson went off to the Philistines to basically spend time with a woman he was interested in marrying, and in the process, a lion met him in the road. It's in the book of Judges. You can read it. But he kills the lion. The power of the Spirit of God came upon him, and he killed the lion as if it were nothing, laid the lion aside, and went on his journey. Well, another time through that same place, he diverted off and said, let me go see what's become of this lion that I slayed. And so he goes, he finds the lion's carcass, and he finds inside this lion's carcass bees making honey. And he takes honey from the lion, eats some of it, gives it to his parents who are with him without telling him where he found it, where he got it from, and goes on his way. And so the sermon was going something along these lines that explained this. Apparently the preacher was saying that he always looks for Christ in the Old Testament. On every story and every page, he wants to find Jesus there. But he had a hard time finding Jesus in this passage. But then he said he finally found it. Found that Samson is Jesus. The lion's the devil, and he killed the devil. The decaying body of the lion. This is the decaying, corrupt world in which we find ourselves. Inside this decaying, corrupt world, you find bees. These are the good Christian people. What are they doing? In the midst of the decaying world, they're making honey. It's very sweet and turning a good thing out of what seems to be death and decay. That's a good example of allegory. Spiritualizing what's just not there. There is a purpose to the story. And we have to ask ourselves, what is the purpose of this story? What's the meaning of this story? And you find a couple of key elements where this part of Samson's story is important. One, in explaining how pretty soon he's going to be at a time with this Philistine woman in a wedding party, and he'll have a riddle out of this situation. This riddle is going to lead to an opportunity for Samson to strike vengeance upon the Philistines. You remember he asks them the riddle of, out of the killer or something, however it goes, out of death, basically, there's something sweet, and there's the riddle, and eventually the wife-to-be of Samson explains the riddle to the Philistines. Samson's furious and does much damage to them. And pretty soon, great enmity between Samson and the Philistines, that God had a purpose in bringing it about. And secondly, the instance of Samson's life shows he wasn't supposed to touch dead carcasses of animals. He was under certain holy vows as a Nazarite to not touch anything of that nature. And he sort of disregarded those vows at different times. And here's an example of it. And you see this because he doesn't tell his parents where he got this honey from. Because, in a sense, he's not supposed to. He knows that. And so there's a purpose to the story. But what is the purpose is the question. So we come to our passage and we say, well, there's a purpose for this statement. He shall bruise your head and you shall bruise his heel. The question is, what does the context lead us to understand from this verse? It'd be very easy to just take all these different stories in the Bible and find a spiritual meaning for them. But is that valid? Is that fair to the text? Is that right? That's the question. So we look here and we ask, what is the context? What is the indication of the passage? Is this a gospel promise? Or is it simply describing the animosity between man and serpent that's to come? Well, look at the big context of the passage. Yes, there's verse 14, where there is definitely reference to simply the natural things that are going to take place for the serpent in the rest of his time on earth. But then there's the bigger context. What's going on with the serpent? What has the serpent been throughout the story? The serpent has been the source of temptation, bringing sin into the world through deceiving the woman. The serpent has been far more than simply a serpent throughout this chapter. He's been the source of temptation for mankind. And I want to note at this point that to say that this is a gospel promise, the snake is more than just a snake, and striking the snake and bruising the snake's head is more than just striking and bruising a snake's head, thus, to say that is not to deny that there are natural elements in this prophecy, in this promise, in this curse. There are natural elements. No doubt, the snake was cursed to crawl on its belly as a result of this. But what we see is that prophecy, and this is a key principle that we'll see again and again as we go through these Old Testament prophecies, prophecy often has two aspects of its time fulfillment, two references. In other words, it's talking about the natural curse on the snake, yes, but there's more. It's that plus there's this further look into history. And this further element of looking forward to the Messiah's coming, the Christ's coming, and a further promise beyond just that natural level. Yes, the snake is cursed on a natural level, but there's more than that beyond that. Prophecy often has that double element, that double reference. And we'll have to understand that and see that, and that'll clarify a lot of things. If we just looked at verse 14 and talked simply about the natural, we wouldn't be wrong to see that there. We would be wrong to mean that then shows that there's not a further element of reference as well, we see. So the context is much bigger than simply a snake and simply enmity or hatred or animosity between man and snake. It's bigger than that. We're dealing with the fall of man, sin entering into the world, paradise being destroyed, all of the created order going out of whack. There's much more than that. Just even looking at the form of it as that other side that wants to limit it to a natural description of things, they looked at the form of it. But if you look at the form also, there's a big difference between the head and the heel. That's another important element. The head is the vital organ. You strike the head, bruise the head. That's the key position of the snake. If, on the other hand, the heel is struck, well, if it's a venomous snake, that could be damaged, but there's no at all implicit reference to this at all. And doing a little damage to your heel is not a major thing, whereas to strike the head is a major thing, a devastation of things. We also know, and this is just looking back, we have the privilege of looking at the New Testament reference to all of this situation. In Old Testament times, they didn't have that, and that's one thing to keep in mind. What could they have known? In other words, when Christ comes, what should they have known at that point already as he comes and they try to understand his ministry and who he is and what he's doing? We have a privilege of having further explanation. And there are New Testament references back to this that we'll look at here just momentarily, where the New Testament makes it very plain and clear, but in reference to this passage, that there's more than just a snake and a man going on. You can go ahead and turn to Revelation chapter 12, where you get a very direct reference back to this passage. Twice in the book of Revelation, we'll look at them both in chapter 12 and in chapter 20. There's a reference very clearly to the devil. And the form of that reference makes it very clear that some of the imagery comes from Genesis 3. Chapter 12 of Revelation, verse 9. So the great dragon was cast out, that serpent of old, called the devil and Satan, who deceives the whole world. He was cast to the earth, and his angels were cast out with him. So you have the serpent of old, called the devil and Satan, no doubt who this serpent is in this verse, who deceives the world. So you have serpent deception, exactly what happens in Genesis 3, and explicitly then called the devil and Satan. And chapter 20 of the same book is very similar, chapter 20, verse 2. He laid hold of the dragon, that serpent of old, who is the devil and Satan, and bound him for 1,000 years. And then if you turn to the book of Romans, chapter 16, you'll find a slightly, perhaps less direct, but still very clear reference to this event, where at the very close of this book to Romans, he gives the church hope and promise when he refers back to this first promise of the gospel in Genesis 3:15. Romans 16:20, Paul tells them that the God of peace will crush Satan under your feet shortly. To crush under your feet, no doubt that has only one reference, that's to Genesis 3:15. Here, though, he does not say he will crush the serpent or the serpent's seed, but Satan himself. So it picks up on this language the New Testament does and makes it very clear once we have the whole Bible in our hands, as we do today, that this Genesis 3:15 verse contains more than simply a naturalistic promise or naturalistic description of what's going to take place between man and serpent. There's more than that going on. Well, at the same time, we may not see everything from the start that we can understand now, yet there are at least a few key elements that should be understood, even when this was first given. And as time, we understand progressive revelation, more and more is given to us to understand, more and more is revealed to us as time goes on. But even at the very point this was given, this first promise was given, there are a few things we should be able to understand. In your notes there, I titled them as broad messianic implications. I see now I skipped over just a few verses in the New Testament. You can go back and look those up. But there's further allusion in the New Testament with this one phrase, from the beginning, in description of Satan. He's one who sins from the beginning in 1 John. He's a murderer from the beginning. He's a liar from the beginning. And this from the beginning, again, must have reference back to the beginning, especially the way the New Testament and the Old Testament uses that phrase, in the beginning. It's what our Bible starts with. That's referencing itself back to this event and connecting Satan very clearly with what's going on here. But the broad messianic implications of this passage, the first gospel, is this. That the seed of woman, basically, will have victory over what happens here. Here man has fallen, but yet in this darkest hour of human history up to this point, and one of the darkest hours in all of human history, if not the darkest, is a promise, a hope, that what has happened here will be undone. What has happened here will be overcome. It's redemption at its heart. Redemption will take place. It doesn't get into all the specific details necessarily, but it gives this one overall promise, this one overall hope, that the center of this promise is that this fall, this great devastation to mankind, is not the final word. There's something that will overcome even this. That here, the serpent, the cause of all the problems in one sense, will be defeated, will be overcome. He'll be overcome by the seed of woman. This makes it very clear that man will do this. Now, I say that carefully, I need to explain that. Man will do this in this sense that Christ becomes man. This is how we know it works out in history, having seen the full picture. They wouldn't have understood all of that from the start, necessarily. But woman, the seed of woman, will do this. Mankind, humanity. One of the reasons it's important to understand the humanity of Jesus Christ. This promise says that man, the seed of woman, will do this. The humanity of Christ is how we see this to be played out ultimately. And also, as a point of importance, it does not necessarily specify one individual yet. We'll find this can be fulfilled with mankind as a whole of some sort, a group of people. It does not yet say one person. Now, it certainly leaves it possible that it is one person. This word seed, the seed of the woman. That seed could have reference to one individual, or it could have reference to all of the descendants, or a group of descendants, something to that effect. It doesn't specify yet. If all you had was this one promise, you would not know, well, there's one individual for sure coming to conquer. We need more than just this one promise to see that. See, we understand it's piece by piece, line upon line, precept upon precept, that we're given fuller knowledge of what's going on. But what we do see here is it's humanity that's at stake. Humanity is what's fallen. Humanity is what must be restored. And it's the seed of woman that will do this. We notice that while we are going to see that the seed crushes or bruises the head of the serpent, it at the same time does not do so without vulnerability, without any harm to himself coming. At the same time, the serpent shall bruise his heel. And just as an example of how this works out, again, we see that Christ does have suffering involved in this. He is not completely invincible from all attacks. He comes in, just as the New Testament explains to us, he's vulnerable to the same temptations as man. He's allowed to be given so much power, in a sense, under the devil. Certainly not full power of any sort. But his sufferings, his hardship in accomplishing this is, to a degree, shown here. When it says this seed will have his heel bruised by the serpent in this process, it's not simply one-sided only. There's even reference here to that other side of it as well. All of that together is what we should see in this chapter 3, verse 15 promise. The first gospel. Redemption of mankind. Mankind will find hope. Mankind will be redeemed somehow. Does not explain fully what happens yet. But this is it's important to see this, and it's very valuable to see the context or the timing of this promise at the very point of failure, the very point of fall, when curse is coming. Yet God's mercy and grace shows through to give promise and hope. This is not a final condemnation. And so you see God's justice, his wrath, his anger, and this punishment of sin, hand in hand with his promises, his gracious promises of hope and fulfillment of these things. They go hand in hand. Again, this is another thing that's characteristic of prophecy. We'll see judgments, condemnations. If you read the prophets, if you read prophecy, there's judgment, there's condemnation, there's judgment, there's condemnation. And all of a sudden, it seems like, there'll be this wonderful picture of hope and perfect peace held out to the people. Because God does not leave us simply all judgment, all condemnation, all wrath. There's always God's hope, God's grace, God's love in the picture at the same time. And combining the two elements of the naturalistic and the supernatural, the beyond just that naturalistic element, even that in and of itself, one final suggestion before we move on, one of the commentators, writers, suggested that bringing these two together, even the twofold application, they're not one and then the other, nothing to do with each other. Bringing them together like this, there's purpose in that, even in this sense, that natural scene that we see around us, every time we see the fallen world, and then every time we see a serpent, is a reminder of the fall and a reminder of the promise that was given at the same time, all contained in one. And then he said there's something divine even in that plan. that we as people here in this world and seeing the effect of this and seeing serpents and that natural rising up fear of hatred for snakes reminds us of all this that's going on. And there's a divine plan in that. So we have this promise from the very start. And now as we look through the book of Genesis, I don't know if we'll get through this whole lesson today or come back to it, we'll see. But this basic, rough promise of great hope is going to be shaped and given more form as we go throughout the book of Genesis and then throughout the rest of the Old Testament. We have the promise at heart already. Chapter 3, verse 15. The promise at heart is given to us right there. Now the form of that is going to be clarified. How that happens is going to be more clearly specified. But we have the promise here. The first place really you see a great addition to this is chapter 5. Not a lot of detail goes on. But at the end of chapter 5, verse 29, we have reference to the birth of Noah. And Noah's birth comes in connection with a promise, a prophecy, that Lamech, his father, gives about Noah. Verse 29 of chapter 5. Lamech called his name Noah, saying, "This one will comfort us concerning our work and the toil of our hands, because of the ground which the Lord has cursed." There's the connection to the curse. You see that? A very clear reference to what happened in Genesis 3. But yet, Lamech says in this son Noah, he says, somehow he knows in the person of Noah we'll find rest from this. In this person of Noah we'll find comfort from this. Somehow, Noah's going to bring about the undoing of that curse, that promise that was given. You see, it's a commentary in a sense, an explanation of how they understood that promise in Genesis 3. They knew they were looking for the comfort from this curse. There was the curse, but there was going to be a comfort from the curse, a rest from this curse, an undoing of that curse. And here in 5:29, Lamech says that Noah is going to be the one through whom this happens. Now we'll find that, again, we have a double element in one sense. Does Noah himself do anything to undo the curse? Well, yes and no. Certainly not fully. And yet we know even Noah himself. We know the flood. We know the story of what happens there. That there is, in a sense, a brief and temporary and at least partial respite from the curse that takes place. God destroys all the evil men of the world. He gives a fresh start to mankind. Now it's not final. And it's not permanent. And it's not very long before this fresh start itself is ruined. And we're spiraling back downhill again as mankind. But yet even in this example we see this double element. There's going to be a picture of redemption given with Noah's flood. And a temporary and partial fulfillment of things that points to still further the final fulfillment of these things. And this is what we talked about last week a little bit when it comes to what's called typology, where we see the flood and no direct statement is made about the flood that this is an example of what's going to happen, but yet it is. And it's an example of further things. It's a picture, a type of what's going to happen when the fulfillment of all these things does come in Christ, where all wickedness will be washed away from the world in a sense. And there will be a complete and final restoration and rest and comfort given to mankind. And Noah embodies this in his life to a degree. It's just a partial picture. It's just a type. It's not the perfect thing. That's coming in the future. But here it is, the promise. What is the promise? What's the basis for it? How does Lamech know there's going to be hope? It's because this promise in Genesis 3. And now what we find is being shaped. Now what we find is a sort of further revelation of how, when, where, all these things. And all that Lamech knows is through Noah. Even Noah's name. Noah's name means rest. Noah's name means comfort, peace, something to this effect. Rest is usually the way it comes. Well, this promise then, given in Genesis 3, then it's given a little further shape in Genesis 5. When you come to Genesis 9, you find yet another promise of these things. This one is somewhat more intricate in a sense that maybe you don't see it right away so clearly. But I think before we're done, you'll see the point of these things. In Genesis 9, 25 through 27, Noah's blessing his son, Shem. You remember Noah got into his drunken, naked state and you remember that his one son saw him in his naked state, Ham, and scoffed at him, wanted to almost make sport of him in this state. But his other two brothers, Shem and Japheth, they covered Noah and showed respect to him. When Noah wakes, he curses, in verse 25, Canaan, who is the son of Ham. We see that in verse 22, Ham is the father of Canaan. In verse 25, then he said, "Cursed be Canaan, a servant of servants he shall be to his brethren." But then the next two verses give us some information. And he said, "Blessed be the Lord, the God of Shem, and may Canaan be his servant. May God enlarge Japheth, and may he dwell in the tents of Shem, and may Canaan be his servant." Ultimately, they say that based on the language and all the way of saying things, that it's pretty clear that Shem is sort of the main actor in respecting his father Noah. Japheth is along, in a sense, agreeing to all that's going on, but really the force and everything behind everything that's going on there is in the person of Shem taking the initiative, and Japheth follows along. And so the first and greatest promise is reserved for Shem. In verse 26, how all this works out, you see this is that, "Blessed be the Lord." And this word "Lord," when it's given in all capitals, as I believe all of your Bibles will have it, all capitals there, what that is the personal name for God. Not God as in the generic word for God that anybody can use anytime, with simply meaning the divine power, whoever that might be. But this is Jehovah, the personal name for God. So blessed be Jehovah, the God of Shem. It's saying that Shem is not just having God, but having Jehovah himself. And this is the first time where we see this name Jehovah given as the God of somebody. The name Jehovah is used before this, but here is the first time where we say Jehovah is somebody's God in particular. And it's Shem's. Shem has a special blessing in this sense. He is given the special privilege of being under the direct lordship of Jehovah. Jehovah himself, the God of Shem. And then Canaan will be his servant. You contrast that emphasis in verse 26 with what happens in verse 27 in regards to Japheth. Japheth also receives a promise. But it doesn't say Jehovah is Japheth's God. May God, Elohim, simply the generic word for God that anybody might use without necessarily understanding the God of the Bible. But God is going to enlarge Japheth. No reference to Jehovah. God is going to enlarge Japheth, and may he dwell in the tents of Shem. Most people think what that actually means, and I've never read it that way until I was studying this a little more carefully. The way that means is Shem's tents will actually be taken over by Japheth. In a sense, this is conquest, military victory, conquest. And again, in history, it does play out that way. This has a historical reference along those lines. On one hand, it's simply saying, in history, Shem is going to be blessed, but then Japheth's seed will take over what happens with Shem's blessing. As God enlarges the tents of Japheth, it will come to include the tents of Shem as his own. But in doing so, we must not miss out on this, that what is he going to bring with the tents of Shem? The God of Shem. The only way Japheth will have Jehovah as his God is through Shem, because Jehovah is Shem's God, you see. And what we have here is a further guiding, directing, and shaping of this promise. That, again, in this context of the book, remember how we talked last week about how there are themes to books that you can trace and see the progress in. We looked at the Gospel of John and the book of Acts. Well, if you look at one of these themes in the book of Genesis, the central promise of chapter 3 that we looked at, and then how that's going to be shaped and directed, and we'll see it before this lesson's over, if not this week, next week, we'll see how it's always being directed from one point in a generation to the next. This promise, this great hope, is always being shaped and given through a certain course of lineage and genealogy, and through a certain course in history, how is this going to come about? We just saw it with Noah. Now we're seeing it with Noah's son, Shem. Japheth, wonderful, he has his promise. But Shem is the one that's chosen to carry on this promise of redemption. Shem has a God, Jehovah, you see. And that's very important to see. Well, we'll go on to chapter 12. where we see Abraham now coming on the scene. And there are a number of promises that Abraham receives. The first one here in chapter 12. Let's read the first three verses. Now the Lord had said to Abram, "Get out of your country, from your family, and from your father's house, to a land that I will show you. I will make you a great nation. I will bless you and make your name great, and you shall be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and I will curse him who curses you. And in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed." The key element that stands out about this promise in regards to what we're saying, yes, there's a blessing given to Abraham. You will be blessed. But more importantly, he will be a blessing to all the families of the earth as well. The families of the earth, in particular, emphasizing the fact that we're dealing with still mankind as a whole. Still in their now in their families, but still mankind as a whole. The curse is on all mankind, and thus all mankind will reap the benefit of this blessing, which implies the reference back to Genesis 3 about how all mankind will have this hope given back to them. The restoration, what they lost at the fall, will be accounted for and redeemed, you see. So the promise given to Abraham is key because it includes all the families of, and I even put in here as a note for you just to get a sense of it, all the families of the Adama, which is the ground, the land, or the earth. And it's important to note this because that's not the most common language term used for the earth. That's a different word. This is the word, you notice if you just take the A-H off, you have Adam. Back in Genesis, the early chapters, when Adam is formed, he's formed as Adam from the Adama. It's ground from the ground. It's Adam from the Adama. And here, we're talking about all the families of the Adama. It's back again, it's recalling to our mind all that happened with Adam, with everything that took on there. It's not the most common word for the earth, in the sense of the planet or the land, but talking in reference back to what we've already seen in these early chapters. So mankind has lost its unity. It's lost everything. But here, all the families of the Adama, the land of the ground, will be blessed through Adam. It's directing that promise again. We can see it from mankind in general, the seed of the woman. All we know at this point is it's somehow the seed of Eve. Then to Noah. Now to Abraham. And we'll see it going on in further connection along these lines. But the same promise is repeated in chapter 18, pretty much. Verse 18 to Abraham. Chapter 18, verse 18. "So that Abraham shall surely become a great and mighty nation, and all the nations of the earth shall be blessed in him." That same emphasis. This is the key thing that's repeated. Chapter 22, verse 18, a third time. This time, with a slight change that becomes more significant later on. But verse 18, "in your seed." And it's also more significant, even at this point, back again in reference to chapter 3, where it talks about the seed of woman. "Now, in your seed, all the nations of the earth shall be blessed, because you have obeyed my voice." So at this point, what we have, ultimately, the central promise of hope given at the very fall of man, carried on to Noah, then carried on to Abraham, and now we're going to see in chapter 26, to Abraham's son, Isaac. This is the passing on of the promise. What promise? What hope is it? It all stems back to Genesis 3. The central promise is given. It's elaborated on in the person of Abraham, because now tied to it are the promises of the land itself and the becoming a great nation, but still of being the blessing to the world. The seed of Abraham will bless all the families, all the nations of the world. Now this promise in Genesis 26 is directed through Isaac. Verse 4. "And I will make your descendants multiply as the stars of heaven. I will give to your descendants all these lands, and in your seed all the nations of the earth shall be blessed." Still dealing with that same promise of Abraham, but now passing it on to Isaac. Same thing happens to Isaac's son. Chapter 28. To Jacob. And this is significant in that Jacob is not the older son of the two. He's brother Esau, is the older of the two. And so it's not simply passing on of family heritage and tradition. What it's showing is that God himself is making a point. God himself is passing on something far greater than simply the traditions of men and the natural flow of things with men. So now Jacob receives the blessing in chapter 28, verse 14. Also your descendants shall be as the dust of the earth, and shall spread abroad to the west and the east, to the north and the south. And in you and in your seed, all the families of the earth shall be blessed. This is Jacob. Remember, as he's fleeing from Esau, sleeping on a rock for a pillow at Bethel, and he gets this vision, this promise from God. So we have this general promise given, very vaguely, in chapter 3. Now it's beginning to take a little more form, primarily in who it will be. Noah, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob. It's not just a natural flow either, though. We see that in each case, God is revealing, and God is choosing, and God is planning this great thing. Again, we're seeing at this point, I think, one of these central themes of the book of Genesis. And if we isolate that theme, we see it more clearly. There are other things in these chapters, no doubt, than just this. But if we isolate and just look at these verses in sequence like this, we begin to see what's going on in the book of Genesis. The book of beginnings, but also it's the beginning of the redemption of man. How it's going to play out in the Old Testament. One more time, as Jacob's sons come to him, chapter 49. By this point, much has changed. Jacob has come down to Egypt with Joseph to see him after many years of thinking he was dead. And now Jacob is on his last few hours and days. And he gathers his sons together to bless them. But more specifically, chapter 49, verse 1, Jacob called his sons and said, "Gather together, that I may tell you what shall befall you in the last days." And very clearly at that point, we should understand we're talking about a promise, the last days. Maybe what exactly that means is debated, but no doubt it looks forward at least to the time of Christ's first coming, perhaps to the very end of time there, the very last days in a literal sense. But in this process, there's a key blessing given to Judah in verse 8. Not Jacob's oldest son, but the promised one will come through Judah, we'll see. Again, you may not see it at first, but when you put it in this context of all that Genesis has been doing, then the blessing given to Judah must become more significant in light of this bigger context of what the book of Genesis has already been doing. Let's read verses 8 through 10. "Judah, you are he whom your brothers shall praise. Your hand shall be on the neck of your enemies. Your father's children shall bow down before you. Judah is a lion's whelp. From the prey, my son, you have gone up. He bows down. He lies down as a lion. And as a lion, who shall rouse him? The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor a lawgiver from between his feet, until Shiloh comes. And to him shall be the obedience of the people." It's particularly in verse 10 that we find the key promise. But even in verse 8, we begin to see things. The name Judah itself has a reference to what it literally means in a sense is, he shall be praised. He shall be praised. Notice verse 8. "Judah, you are he whom your brothers shall praise." That word from which Judah's name derives, he shall be praised, is perhaps never, maybe in a few cases, used of man. And so, anytime you see that word from which Judah's name comes, you get this sense, God will be praised. And here it says to Judah, "You shall be the one whom your brother shall praise. You are he whom your brother shall praise." There's a reference even in that, most likely, to something beyond just Judah. Judah cannot take the place of God. God is the one who shall be praised. And almost invariably, the use of this word, some people think invariably. There are a couple references where some people think it's referring to man, where others say, yes, man, but only in this type of logical sense, in the same way we might be talking about being used here with Judah. Yes, it says Judah, but is Judah more than Judah, you see, as a type, in a sense, looking forward to what's going to come in Christ, what verse 10 comes to, as Shiloh. So here, Judah is the one who is praised. Everywhere else, pretty much, God is that one, according to the use of this word. Even when Judah gets his name, his mother Leah says, "I will praise God this time. this time I'll praise God. It's even in his giving of the name, the praise is to God, not to Judah. So here from the very start, Judah, you are he whom your brother shall praise. That could be taken just as a very natural sixth sense again. Judah will receive praise. But even the basis of the word, and as we go on further, the further implications more clearly, is probably looking at Judah again in reference to what Judah will become in his seed, Christ, eventually, as Christ does come through the seed of Judah. His brothers will bow down to him. Again, could just be in a sense of respect, but is it something more than that? Well, verse 10, the scepter shall not depart from Judah. You'll remember last week we talked about Christ's three offices based on what it means to be anointed. One of them is king. This is actually going to be the most central concept, particularly in the Old Testament, king. What's a scepter? A scepter is rule. A scepter is authority. In other words, you will be the one who rules. The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor a lawgiver from between his feet, until Shiloh comes. Who is Shiloh? This is probably the first time that we see a name given to the Messiah, a name given to Christ, and at the same time, the first time we actually see one individual as the figure, the person who will come and win this victory and redeem mankind. So far, it's the seed of, the seed of, the seed of. That could be one person. Certainly doesn't necessarily have to be one person. But here is Shiloh. Shiloh will come. You will reign Judah until Shiloh comes. Shiloh then will have the rule. He will have it perfectly in completion. Allah says the scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor a lawgiver from between his feet until Shiloh comes, and to him shall be the obedience of the people. Shiloh's name itself, it's somewhat uncertain what it means, but some people think at least it's peace. Rest from the word for peace in the Old Testament, the Hebrew word Shiloh. Shiloh. At this point, what we see more clearly are times about God, but we've traced the promise through Genesis. From this general promise in chapter 3, the fall of man, to Noah, to Abraham, to Isaac, to Jacob, and now to his son, Judah. And Judah becomes a figure, in a sense. He'll be the one who receives praise, in that Christ is the one who is to be praised, and in that Christ is God. All of a sudden, there's an intimation, at least, a possibility, that even this one deliverer is more than just a man, because he's receiving praise as well. He will be bowed down to. Everybody will obey him, in a sense, as the final culmination of what is going on. Peace will come, an individual person. It will be a kingly rule, and all that is going on. At this point, we should have a pretty clear understanding of the shape this promise is taking. As it's traced down these peoples and traced down these generations, now we're looking for a distinct figure, an individual, to reign as king, to be have the obedience of the peoples to him, coming from the seed, even at this point, as specifically as the seed of Jacob. Well, we'll trace on beyond Genesis how this becomes more clear throughout the rest of the Old Testament, ultimately getting up to the times of the New Testament when Christ comes, and we'll see how he fulfills all these things.